prolonged discussion about two matters. One was the whole issue of religion, about Hinduism. And what Sri Aurobindo has to say about what made it run in a different manner, so to say, than the Western or Occidental formations of religion. And the other was with regard to psychology as a discipline. And we talked about some of the new ways in which the occult is being addressed, new formations of psychology that are coming up, like parapsychology, and also we discussed integral psychology. And I had also sent two links to some things that which I had written on these subjects. So I wanted to, sort of ask if anybody had any questions or comments on those before we proceed.
I actually haven't read the links yet, so I'll just listen in before I ask any questions yet. Shall I start by reading the chapter beginning with, the paragraph beginning with an intellectual approach? Or should we start with the previous one, occultism is associated? I wasn't sure if we wanted to start reading Occultism is Associated, the path starting with that, or do you want to read the next one, An Intellectual Approach?
Yeah, I think we can read.
Hello?
No, I think we can read from there. Occultism is associated with popular. That's the second paragraph having to do with occultism. And we can read from there.
Sure, let me start. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, sure, I can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, this is page 876. Occultism is associated in popular idea with magic and magic formulae and a supposed mechanism of the supernatural. But this is only one side, nor is it altogether a superstition, as is vainly imagined by those who have not looked deeply, or at all, at this covert side of secret nature force, or experimented with its possibilities. Formulas and their application, a mechanization of latent forces, can be astonishingly effective in the occult use of mind power and life power, just as it is in physical science. But this is only a subordinate method and a limited direction. for mind and life forces are plastic, subtle, and variable in their action, and have not the material rigidity. They need a subtle and plastic intuition in the knowledge of them, in the interpretation of their action and process, and in their application, even in the interpretation and action of their established formulas. An overstress on mechanization and rigid formulation is likely to result in sterilization or a formalized limitation of knowledge, and on the pragmatic side, to much error, ignorant convention, misuse, and failure. Now that we are outgrowing the superstition of the sole truth of matter, a swing backward towards the old occultism and to new formulations, as well as to a scientific investigation of the still hidden secrets and powers of mind, and a close study of psychic and abnormal or supernormal psychological phenomena is possible and in parts already visible. But if it is to fulfill itself, the true foundation... Hang on, Devashda seems to have been dropped. I'll try to add him back.
Guys, I think I'm going to bow out this evening. I will listen to the recording tomorrow. So, good night.
Yeah, but if it is to fulfill itself, the true foundation, the true aim and direction, the necessary... The true aim and direction, the necessary restrictions. This is I just wait for the Vashishtha to connect once more. Yeah, but if it is to fulfill itself, the true foundation, the true aim and direction, the necessary restrictions and precautions of this line of inquiry have to be rediscovered. Its most important aim must be the discovery of the hidden truths and powers of the mind force and the life power and the greater forces of the concealed spirit. Occult science is essentially the science of the subliminal in ourselves and the subliminal in world nature, and of all that is in connection with the subliminal, including the subconscious and the superconscious, and the use of it as part of self-knowledge and world knowledge, and for the right dynamization of that knowledge.
Sham, did you just finish that paragraph?
Yeah, that's correct. I just finished the paragraph.
Oh, okay. Because strangely, I think what is happening is, I don't know whether it was happening to others, but you were coming on and off. It was I missed the last part of it, but that's okay. So if others heard it, that's fine.
I can read the last two sentences again.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'll start.
Actually, for me, it was fine. Just wanted to let you know.
Okay, so it's not a problem.
Okay.
Let's continue.
I heard that also.
Okay, good. I think, you know, just my system is probably kind of acting up a little bit, but, you know, I think this paragraph we did last time, as you were reading it, I realized that we've already done this paragraph, and essentially it is the second of the paragraphs. He doesn't spend too much time on this occultism aspect as much as he has on religion. He has one very long, or I think he has three paragraphs, go for about 2.5 pages. And essentially, he's making the case that this is part of our knowledge, subject knowledge. It is part of our knowledge of psychology, and it's related to what he has elsewhere called the psychological ignorance. That essentially it is the life of the ego or the consciousness that is operating in the dynamics of the surface personality that we are aware of, and behind it the laws of the subliminal are rather
I can't hear Devashish.
Me neither. He's been dropping quite a bit as he just did us again. Was the connection pretty bad last week too, or is it only this time? It's only this time. Whoa, I dropped cake.
What is that noise?
That's the Yeah, hello, Devashinder.
Shyama was also wondering, you know, I'm thinking, you know, Sita has this kind of professional account or something.
Yeah, I do not believe that there's any difference. It's only that it allows, if we have more than 12 people, it allows you to hold the conference. Other than that, we didn't see much difference in the quality itself. Yeah, Debashiza.
Hello.
Yeah, hello. Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me, Debashiza?
Hello.
I can hear you, Debashiza. Hello.
Oh.
Yeah, hello.
Hello. Perhaps we can continue, because this is essentially you have been just making a case for a computer psychological knowledge which will open the doors to the inner life and the mind forces and life forces, as he's pointing out that same kinds of laws pertain to the surface nature, don't necessarily pertain to the inner life. And deeper ranges ultimately open us to.
I think is not muted, so it's making loud. I think it could be because of the mouse rolling or something. I don't know.
My mic?
No, Vince. I was telling Vince, And he has already muted.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as he says over here, occult science is essentially the science of the subliminal. And so, and the subliminal has the two ranges. It's a much more Buddhist consciousness, where we are constantly receiving and sending out forces. It is these ranges that Sri Aurobindo is dealing with. As some of the things he talks about under Vijnana Chatushtha of yoga. So this, these forces connect the universe life, and then behind it there is, you know, the super conscient, as he says, and that ultimately opens. These forces are the way that the forces operate in these ranges, you know, helps us to enlarge our consciousness and know more of. Perhaps we should proceed to the next paragraph, unless you would like to discuss this a little further. See, what I had
sure.
done is, pardon?
Sure, we can do that. Keka, do you want to read?
I draw your attention, if you have a chance,
uh-huh.
I sent those links.
Sure.
You know, one of them had to do with, you know, we talked about last time in conclusion, in the concluding paragraphs regarding religion, where Sri Aurobindo.
Crazy.
Also must be enlightened and satisfied. Our thinking and reflecting mind must be helped to understand, to form a reasoned and systematized idea of the goal, the method, the principles of this highest development and activity of our nature, and the truth of all that lies behind it. Spiritual realization and experience, an intuitive and direct knowledge, a growth of inner consciousness, a growth of the soul and of an intimate soul perception, soul vision, and a soul sense are indeed the proper means of this evolution. But the support of the reflective and critical reason is also of great importance. If many can dispense with it because they have a vivid and direct contact with inner realities and are satisfied with experience and insight. Yet, in the whole movement, it is indispensable. If the supreme truth is a spiritual reality, then the intellect of man needs to know what is the nature of that original truth and the principle of its relations to the rest of existence, to ourselves and the universe. The intellect is not capable by itself of bringing us into touch with the concrete spiritual reality, but it can help by a mental formulation of the truth of the spirit, which explains it to the mind and can be applied even in the more direct seeking. This help is of a capital importance.
So here Sri Aurobindo is moving from occultism to spiritual philosophy. This is the third limb of the emergence of the spiritual man and what it depends on. And here he's making a very strong case for the necessity of the intellectual understanding of the spiritual reality and its relation with the cosmos and with the individual. So, as he points out, the way to the spiritual reality is through the growth of consciousness. And he gives us the various bases, one may say, by which reality or truth has to be approached. First, he's talking about spiritual realization and experience. This is the ultimate bedrock of truth. It is by experience that truth is realized. But to get there, there are inner faculties that must develop. And one of the powers that brings us closer to it is an intuitive seeing. So next thing he talks about is an intuitive and direct knowledge. So intuitive and direct knowledge are two kinds of knowledge, in fact. And they relate to what Sri Aurobindo calls knowledge by identity and knowledge by inner contact. So these two forms of knowledge, one of them, this direct knowledge, pratyaksha, is something which is resting on spiritual experience. Spiritual experience informing the understanding of the inner mind, or rather of the higher mind planes, or even beyond that. But the intuitive contact with truth is established by the inner being, guided by the psychic intuition or the inner mind intuition. So that is, those are the next layers or levels of contact with truth or reality. Then he moves on to talk about the growth of consciousness. Because none of these things can really be achieved until and unless consciousness grows. A growth of inner consciousness, a growth of the soul, and of an intimate soul perception. So that is where the growth of the inner consciousness and the growth of the soul relate to those stages that Sri Aurobindo has pointed out earlier regarding entry into the inner being and the development of the yogic consciousness, and further the coming to the front of the psychic being. So these openings are necessary. So these are the stages, actually stated in a reverse order. He goes first from spiritual realization down the line through the development of direct and indirect, or knowledge by identity and knowledge by inner contact, to the idea of the growth of the yogic consciousness, the inner mental consciousness, and the development of the psychic perception. So this is the way by which psychic perception, the psychic intuition, the psychic discrimination starts radiating the inner being. And as that happens, there is greater and greater access to knowledge by direct contact, the inner contact. And as that grows, we come closer and closer to true experience and knowledge by identity. So it's a whole progression that he lays out in reverse order over there. And yet he says that to all this must be added the development of the intellectual understanding. So this, in another way of speaking, is how Sri Aurobindo explains the whole field of the spiritual endeavor in Indian discourse. Just as he has touched on the field of religious discourse in India, this is his way of touching on the field of spiritual discourse in India. And the occult field leads into this, because in a sense, what he has spoken of regarding the occult is brought to a more concrete understanding over here. When he talks about that succession of the growth of consciousness leading to knowledge of truth and knowledge by identity. So that entire range of experience has to do with what we call psychology, or rather what Sri Aurobindo calls psychology. There is a place where he says, yoga is nothing but practical psychology. So this practical psychology applied to oneself, an applied psychology to one's own nature, to the development of the nature and of the consciousness, constitutes the field of yoga. But along with this field of yoga must also grow our understanding of what it is that we are experiencing. This understanding guides us, allows us to develop a certain kind of, even if it's tentative, schematic into which we grow. See, we are constantly building, as it were, these edifices that guide us to make a settled thing of our experience. The mind creates a home for experience. You know, it's a dwelling place for experience in our own consciousness. See, otherwise what happens in the consciousness of the mystic, experiences come and go, but they don't add to each other to form a certain body of realization. Form a body of realization, one needs to put experiences in place and arrange them in some order. Now, one may say that such an order already exists, and one can find it through spiritual experience. And this is true. But at the same time, the training of the mind to get there on its way is something that aids a lot this spiritual development. So this is the point Sri Aurobindo is making. There is another aspect to it as well, which he's touching on, which is that the intellect in its own progress and in its sort of march along with the growth of the yogic consciousness, the growth of experience, is something that makes available to the universe the fruits of yoga. Were it not stated in terms of a cosmology, in terms of some kind of schema for relating consciousness to consciousness, then this edifice of experience would not be generally available. People would not be able to see or understand what it is that they're going into. See? So this generalization is one of the great benefits of the growth of the progress of intellect in forming a spiritual philosophy. It's a very, this little paragraph contains a lot, but it also contains, as most other things do in Sri Aurobindo, cross-cultural references. Here, of course, what is backgrounding it is the understanding of the place of philosophy, not in isolation, not as the mind's speculative activity for its own sake, see, just for the creation of abstract schemes, but subjected to the growth of consciousness. So that's where the dual powers, the two wings of yoga and darshana come into place. The whole of the Indian field of spiritual discourse is so solid because these two are always together. Yoga to push us into the world of experience, and darshana to give meaning to that particular realm of experience. And for that, the development of spiritual philosophy is absolutely essential.
I mean, I was looking at this mind and supermind chapter of Life Divine. Can I read few lines?
Yeah, sure, please.
It says, mind in its essence is a consciousness which measures, limits, cuts out forms of things from the indivisible whole and contains them as if each were a separate integer. Even with what exists only as obvious parts and fractions, mind establishes this fiction of its ordinary commerce that there are things with which it can deal separately and not merely as aspects of a whole. For even when it knows that they are not things in themselves, it is obliged to deal with them as if they were things in themselves. I just wanted to read just this part because I think this, as I remember, ultimately it leads to the fact that it is actually mind, see, as a subordinate of the supermind. It's actually, it was the intention of experiencing the world of for the supermind through mind as, you know, fixing the consciousness at one point and looking at something else as not itself. Like supermind can extend consciousness and apprehend and all that, but it is always thinking of what it is looking at as also itself, meaning it is always with the knowledge by identity. But in the mind's case, it actually fixes as if what it is looking at is not itself. So is that level of objectivization is, it's in a way ignorant, but it is also another way of measuring from the supermind's perspective. So I just thought of, I don't know where exactly that fixing and not itself, that part, but I believe that it is in the same chapter.
Yeah, no doubt, absolutely. And actually, you see, that is the what makes the play of difference possible. The whole idea of the truth of the ignorance of the evolutionary play is made possible due to that power of creating separate realities that can each stand as an integer, as Sri Aurobindo points out over there. And that is also the danger of mind, in the sense that if each of these poses as its only integer, as it's the only truth, then you have a field of war, a field of conflict, and the mental differentiation becomes a differentiation that lends itself to this kind of warring philosophies or religions, etc. But at this ideologies, but at the same time, that's why it's so important to subordinate it to the growth of the experience. And if there is an intuition of unity guiding the growth of consciousness and tentative schema created by the mind in which these realities are given their place, then we have, on the other hand, this kind of field of darshan in which there is a certain harmony and a growth which is aided by the development of spiritual philosophy.
Debashista, Western philosophy, is that also part of spiritual philosophy?
No, by and large, no. You see, that is where the problem lies, that by and large, the field of Western philosophy is one which rests too much on the power of reason to arrive at truth. You see, this is where the big distinction occurs. And actually, in some sense, modern philosophers, contemporary philosophers, have put their finger on this. They have seen how, even from the time of Aristotle, and some people see it going back to Socrates, that this particular divorce or dividing between experience, between what one might call mysticism or experience yoga and philosophy took place. To some extent, we find it in people like Socrates and Plato, that, you know, their philosophizing is being guided by some aspect of consciousness. But gradually, it loses itself in pure mental speculation. It's almost as if mind can arrive at truth. That becomes the faith of philosophy in the West. Several contemporary philosophers have, in a sense, pointed to what is called the pre-Socratic tradition of Greek thinking and the difference that took place when that was pushed aside. That kind of thinking is, in some sense, closer to the intuitive sort of utterances of the Upanishads. So perhaps there was a kind of a post-Upanishadic period where there is this age of thinking, which is spiritual thinking, what he's calling the development of spiritual philosophy, that is different from the nature of speculative spiritual philosophy. You know, something that creates a schema in the name of God without arriving at the experience of God. See, and there's a big problem that arises due to that. These thinkers, particularly contemporary thinkers, they are pointing to the difficulties that have arisen due to that kind of divorce between spiritual philosophy, if you want to call it that, and experience, the power of mystic experience.
Devesh, that's not really something that has come about consciously, is it? It is more of just the, natural growth of the system rather than anything, any particular planned emphasis on logic, isn't it?
But you see, what happens is that the aim of philosophy changes. When you have a very powerful figure who creates a hegemonic school, this is how, in fact, the field of knowledge is always subject to the field of power. Everything, in fact, has to be studied. All social phenomena have to be studied in terms of the field of power. How is it that certain things become prioritized over others and hold the attention of the human race, sometimes for centuries? It is due to some particular operations of power somewhere that this happens. So, you know, basically that, you know, what you called about the priority of logic, today people are talking about it as logocentrism. Logocentrism has to do with the logos. Logos means, rather than, you know, to talk about the unnameable or the unknowable that has its reality, that has projected itself into the universe, that can be known. If we turn that into a different kind of cosmic faith and say that whatever is cosmic is knowable, because ultimately whatever we call divine is the logos, is knowledge as rationally knowable, then immediately we created a world in which we posited ourselves as knowing subjects. So that happens at a certain point of time, and since then that tends to dominate the whole of Western philosophical seeking. So you see, cultures remain more or less insulated from each other. You see, for example, if you talk about India and the kind of distinction that he's making here, if you talk about China and these kinds of other cultures, what they understand by the place of mind or the place of philosophy could be very different. Philosophy there is subordinated to the impulse of the growth of consciousness, or maybe to the impulse of social life, that is what we call social philosophy, etc., or moral philosophy, etc. But the philosophy of knowledge and of being, if it develops speculative basis on the faith that rationally we may arrive at the reason that structures the universe, then we have, in a sense, created a wall between the life of the spirit and the life of the mind. And that is something that guides, in a sense, the history of Western thinking. And also, you know, that is what, in a sense, creates the distinction between religion and philosophy or the secular sort of world in the West.
So, Debashisna, talking of, as you just did, of the influence that power has over the debate, would you say that when it comes to the religious field, like in India, the power is not centralized, whereas, say, in Christianity or Islam, like the power tends to get centralized?
Yeah, surely that certainly has something to play, at least in the religious field. Definitely that has a very major impact to play, because ultimately the reason why power is not centralized in Indian religions is for the same thing that we are talking about with regard to Indian philosophy. That is, the life of consciousness is given its freedom. Now, if instead the life of consciousness is relegated to somebody else's experience, in other words, you're being told that a prophet came and he was graced by some angel Gabriel's commandments or whatever, and that's it, from that point on, you have to take it for granted. Then you need a social mechanism to keep people in line, because people may question it. So then you have the whole edifice of social power that goes with religions. It isn't that such social power doesn't exist in India or doesn't exist in Hinduism. It exists in a major way. It exists both externally and internally. The theory of karma, for example, is one of those conscience building tools by which these kind of ideologies can maintain their hold on people. But nevertheless, there isn't that kind of centralized control over the lives of people through law. There is also, to some extent, Hindus can be ostracized from the pack of Hindus. They can be outcast, so to say. But at the same time, that is the relatively small, kind of price to pay in a country in which, there are innumerable gurus and innumerable paths to the divine. And nobody is going to burn you at the stake as a witch. That is certainly a kind of major difference as far as the history of religion is concerned.
Thank you, Devashista.
Devashista, the word logos is Mahavakya, isn't it, in Sanskrit?
Logos?
Is Mahavakya, no, in Sanskrit?
Maybe you can look at it something like that. You can look, the logos can be considered the divine word. Mahavakya usually we think of as a kind of a sort of cornerstone of darshana.
Uh-huh.
That is some great sort of statement by which an entire darshana can be sort of captured. But again, yeah, if you even talk about it like that, basically these Brahma Satya Jagan Mithya, that is a Mahavakya, right? So anything of that kind is there really for experiencing, is there to be realized in the Indian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
While there, it would be something so as to be understood as something that exists in an objectified manner. That is the truth or law that has objectified itself in the world. And to know that is enough. And to know that opens it to the field of power manipulations. If you know the law that structures the universe, you can modify the structure of the universe. So that becomes, in a sense, the objectified understanding of this whole field that arises out of the sundering of inner experience and spiritual philosophy.
So the modern philosophers would not call this logocentric approach as the right approach.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that is past.
Yeah, no, but when I say modern, I mean a certain school, you could say the whole sort of lineage of what are called postmodern thinkers, they point to this problem. That doesn't mean all thinkers point to this kind of problem. But what to do with that? That is another question altogether. Does that mean that we can then arrive at some truth through experience? Now, the traditions have not been developed for that. Whether we talk about the field of religion or we talk about the field of philosophy, the tradition of a systematic approach to the growth of the spirit has not been sufficiently developed in the West. See, mysticism exists, but that's exactly the point I'm making. And I think that's part of exactly the subtext of this particular paragraph, which is that since the mind has not been given as the, sort of subordinate of the enterprise of developing the growth of consciousness and relating it to all its various precedents and antecedents, that's the reason why, in a sense, you don't have that tradition of sort of spiritual development that allows a philosophy which is seeking now for that kind of a validation to find it.
Vishishta, I missed the context in the beginning. I was trying to understand the logocentric approach versus experience based approach of religion and spirituality. Is the logocentric approach by definition, because it focuses on the external phenomena by and large, because it tries to understand, will deprive you of the experience?
Yeah, you see, logocentric approach means, in a sense, that, you know, I mean, the notion of Mahavakya is a good one to at least approach it. That is that we can find a logic. Okay, the word logic comes out of logos, in fact, that we can find an ultimate logic to this universe. Okay? That is also the grand intuition of science that looks for a grand unifying theory. It's looking for a theory that can explain everything. Okay? So, as far as philosophy is concerned, it doesn't go about this the same way as science does. Though there are big debates where science has tried to basically illegitimize the whole domain of speculative philosophy, which is not scientific. In other words, what it calls natural philosophy is the domain of science. And modernity is marked to some extent by the effort to outcast any other kind of philosophy. See? But nevertheless, philosophers have stood their ground. And they have said that there are other ways by which we can arrive at the logos. So what are these other ways by which we can arrive at the logos? Well, one of the example of that logocentric thinking, one of the most major logocentric thinkers of our times is Hegel, for example. Okay. Because Hegel uses a kind of speculative structure of thinking, which we might say to some extent is intuitive, and it's brilliant, because, you know, if you follow it, you'll find that there is a lot in it that, you know, is similar to Sri Aurobindo. He's actually drawing attention to certain kinds of intuitive perceptions which otherwise we don't ordinarily have, and out of those perceptions he's arriving at certain conclusions. And with these conclusions, he is creating a structure for the cosmos and for the human place in it. So we could say that the order of the universe, that is basically ordering, you know, the name of God as the order of the cosmos, is the whole enterprise of logocentrism. Okay? But it is arrived at using the reason, and is based on the supposition that that's the highest faculty that human beings have, and that in fact is equated with consciousness itself. Consciousness is rationality. Okay, so that is essentially the equation that drives the approach of logocentrism in Western philosophy.
The processes used in both are the same, just the focus is different. Is that the way? Is it correct understanding?
Sita, can you repeat the first part of your question? It got cut a little bit.
So the processes used in both the approaches are similar, and the focus is different. Is that the way to understand it? One is the focus the other philosophies is mainly geared towards experience, and the other is towards finding a schema is the focus of the other rather than the experience of it. But the processes followed are one and by and large the same. So for example, even Sri Aurobindo's philosophy and Vivekananda also say things like, if it doesn't, you know, you find, intuitively you find a means, a way, what works for you and listen to that and go with that. Whatever doesn't fit that, you can kind of take your inner guidance and move forward. That is one. And whatever doesn't fit your formula, you can kind of work within your system and kind of come up with a order and understanding is the other. So I see that processes are kind of similar in both, but the focus seems to be different. One is for trying to find a schema, other is mainly towards an experience. Is that the correct way to think about it?
Yeah, to some extent, yeah. Largely, you're right, Sita. The only thing I'd say is that not only is the process the same, but in both cases, we are trying to arrive at a schema. But the difference really, I think, is in the fact that in one case, man is taken as a fixed and settled thing, given what we call common human nature. And in the other case, man is taken as a transitional being that can experience reality in its conscious form beyond the, you know, beyond the present human. So that is really where the problem lies. The use of mind and its tools, including the tools of intuition, to arrive at schema, to arrive at orders or ordered realities of the cosmos, is the aim in both cases. But in one case, that is being utilized, taking the human being as a fixed datum. I am the measure from which everything will be measured, okay? The reality will be measured with my present status unquestioned. While in the other case, the human being is taken as a tentative and unstable point that is basically growing itself ultimately into equation with the universe. So the growth of consciousness is what is the difference. And utilizing the same tools to come up with schema takes on a totally different meaning if you make that assumption and link it to that practice.
Thank you.
So you see, it makes a tremendous difference, not only from the viewpoint that it is subordinated to the growth of consciousness. The meaning of consciousness is different. The meaning of logos becomes different. In other words, logos is no longer something which is merely knowable by the mind, but experienceable in identity and ultimately unknowable. You see, that's really one of the major differences. That the unknowability, the appearance of knowledge as something which can be objectified from a mystery which encompasses the cosmos and goes beyond it, is part of this entire, sort of formulation of consciousness moving into identity. That is one aspect of it. The other aspect which is key and I think very important, not only in its conclusion but from its very beginning stages, is that once you subordinate the power of spiritual philosophy to the growth of consciousness, it no longer becomes the creator of ideologies that will become arbiters of truth. So this problem of ideologies clashing with one another, this problem of separate ways of viewing reality that ultimately pose as reality itself. See, this ability for a way of a seeing or a way of being to pose as reality itself and therefore to in some way contest other realities and try to throw them out of the field is one of the major problems that arises out of logocentrism. But that problem is no longer there if we assume that this field only exists so as to create schema that help the growth of consciousness.
Debashish, in the Western study, has psychology and philosophy gotten as intermingled as, for example, as Sri Aurobindo does?
Well, you know, only in the modern period we find that definitely there are many psychological philosophies that have arisen. You see, philosophies, phenomenology, for example, is purely a psychological philosophy, you would call it. So, you know, psychological philosophies make their bid for restructuring the whole field of metaphysics from the time of Nietzsche. And basically, you can see Nietzsche is one of the great teachers of the modern Western world who's talking about the making of the Superman. In other words, man is a transitional being. So the West changes its whole idea. You see, for Hegel also, there is an evolution taking place. But man is at the very height of that evolution. I mean, the appearance of the mind for him and for the collective growth of mind to arrive at knowledge of the world, as we are seeing today, by the power of various kinds of academic sort of knowledges, seems to have been the height at which, you know, he thought God has been realized. But not so for thinkers like Nietzsche, who claimed that it is for the individual to outstrip humanity, see, to become the Superman.
Actually, I would like to go quite far back in this conversation when Shyam first asked the question about in India, is it not centralized or something like that? So it just a thought came in my mind that could it be that, I mean, first of all, that it's a manifestation of power, right? So basically, it get that power, that power, though in a deformed way, but it's also playing through religions. Basically, it is the game of power. And as you, as Debashish, you were saying, but in India particularly, things are a little different when it goes to religion. I was thinking whether it is because of this, you know, ancient Vedic and all these other, you know, legacy that the rishis have some sort of invoked these gods and goddesses to manifest their qualities on earth. And somehow, because it's just my, in experience in India, that as if the gods and goddesses have some reality which is more tangible in India than anywhere else. So it is one way, it is that it's difficult for any human being or any kind of messiah to take over things because certain qualities are already predominant, not necessarily in a positive way, it could be negative also, but you know, so that is one thing. So it's difficult for some messiah to take over, overpower. So that is one good thing, and also a bad thing because it is more difficult to centralize. So probably, you know, it needs a very high power of like Sri Aurobindo and the mother, that kind of power to be able to integrate.
Perhaps, you see, as you were pointing out, you see that when you're talking about the fact that even in the religions, the you know, gods are more tangible in some sense in India. Well, there's two things to say there. One is that perhaps that is because the field of experience has been kept alive. So, since the field of experience has been kept alive, mystics and spiritual people have experienced the realities of these gods. Even in common life, that distance of something which is very far away or which is reduced to a name or an order is something that, you know, it's much more pervasive as, you know, as the possibility of an experience. On the other hand, I'd say that in Western religion, that element is not lacking, you see, because we do find that, you know, the centralization and the social power that is associated with it is one thing, but, you know, tremendous amount of faith in a variety of kind of Christian formulations, so that people feel these to be very real and living to them, does exist as well. I think the problem is when these particular realities start becoming fossilized, so that you start feeling this is the only way. If that was to happen, say, for example, if all the Vaishnavs felt that, you know, Vishnu is the only God, is real to us, but anybody else who thinks of Shiva as being a God, we must, you know, put him to hell or something like that, then that would have happened. But fortunately, because the field was so plural, there were so many ways of approaches admitted, people could share their different approaches, that kind of reality that you're talking about, even in the field of religion, is more taken for granted.
I mean, no, I don't know, it could be my cultural bias since I've been brought up in India. What I was referring to is that, I mean, even if you are not religious, say I was not at all into religion, like I didn't even believe in anything. But now that I came to India, I mean, if I compare between the West and here, that in the West, even if there are names and things, of course, I'm sure many people believe that as real, but somehow in the atmosphere, it is not as tangible. Or I mean, even for a person's experience who is very open and has no inclination towards any particular religion, even for that person, I mean, it is actually... there is some substantial, establishment of different gods with their qualities, no matter how it is deformed by people.
No, yeah, it's very possible. Now, of course, as you're saying, one way of looking at it would be to say that the power of invocation of the Vedas and Upanishads have made the gods alive, and they exist in a more living sense in the atmosphere, and there may be some truth to that. But also we may say that whether we want to look at it like that or not, the very living experience, I mean, that's where the, you know, living of the experience of these realities among large numbers of people have kept it alive, so that, you know, in a sense, the whole field of Western culture is living what is known, what Nietzsche called, the twilight of the gods. The gods have departed, you see, from the West, because in a sense, this particular logocentric kind of move has automatically led to a point where nothing exists that cannot be known, as it were. It's brought under the domain of mental thinking. So that has not happened, say in India, for example. However rational Indians may be, logocentric ideology is not something that kind of drives our common understanding of reality. So that way also one can see that the atmosphere carries something else in experience than an atmosphere in which the gods have fled.
I mean, to some extent, that is work acting in a positive side also in the West, so that they can, you know, idealize and integrate, and even at the human level, since, you know, they don't need to go in the spiritual level to universalize, at least to some extent, right?
Absolutely. In fact, that's the kind of major departure that Nietzsche announces. Because his kind of, you know, whole sort of thing begins by saying that God is dead. It's the twilight of the gods, the departure of the gods, that prepares the ground or creates the opening for the Superman, for him, where mankind must become God. You see, that hole which has been opened up due to the departure of the spirits to whom in whom we relied yesterday will create the possibility of mankind's aspiration to equate himself in experience with God. Now, of course, there are many nuances to this, and one may say, is he talking about a magnified ego, or is he really talking about surrender to a supreme? You know, we don't need to get into those arguments, but certainly, yeah, as you were saying, there is a positive side to it as well, and that is part of that positive side.
Debashishta, the term post-human, is that what Nietzsche was talking about?
Come again, what is that term?
The term post-human.
Yeah, no, Nietzsche does not actually use that term post-human. Post-human term is more a contemporary term. It is a term that is used by contemporary Western philosophers. To some extent, who start by saying that the idea of the human is a modern formation, is a modern idea. You see, let me just explain that a little bit. You see, what does it mean to be human? That particular concern. Who is human and what does it mean to be human does not enter in that sense to minds of the pre-modern world. We are human. We may think of what is it that we, you know, are psychologically, for example, but the notion that, you know, a certain race or species called the human exists, that is the same anywhere in the world. All these people that have characteristics that we have are called human. Already it makes this kind of field something that calls for self-definition. Again, it's part of the logocentrism. To announce the human is also to announce the search for the boundaries of the human. What is it that makes us human? So you can say that the whole Western Enlightenment begins partly with this notion of going around the world to find all these other human beings and to find that which is common to them. And if somehow that which is in the Western is not replicated in others, either you call them not sufficiently human. Okay, that's the whole problem of racism and apartheid, in which other races are kind of given non-human status. To some extent, we're more like apes than humans. Or you feel that they can be tutored and they can be civilized so that they become human. So idea of the human is a modern construct, which is very closely also associated with the academic disciplines of sociology, psychology, anthropology, and archaeology. They define what it is, the human. You see, how to the discipline of studying characteristics that we can call human. So what happens is that in contemporary times, philosophers have defied that. They have said that entire domain of trying to arrive at a settled idea of the human is faulted at its base because mankind cannot be defined in those terms. Therefore, to talk of the post-human in some sense is to talk of that escape from the definitions of these disciplines that try to bind you know, what we call the human species to certain laws.
I see, because I saw you use that term in that in the integral psychology link that you sent us last time.
There are many things that go into it, including what we were talk. I was earlier talking about Hegel, who essentially says that once mankind's mind as a collective mentality has arrived at all the knowledge that it can get, you know, once it has built this archive of knowledge, which we are almost on the kind of verge of, it seems, you know, with the push of a button, you can get whatever knowledge you want, except it's all objectified knowledge. So that kind of knowledge is the culmination of the human. And at that point, history comes to an end. He talks about the end of history. Okay. So what would happen with the end of history as far as Hegel is concerned? God has served his purpose, as it were. See? So the idea is something which is already in some sense kind of, you know, sort of absurd. And so absurdism arises at that point. But the notion of the post-human is that beyond so-called end of history, you have another kind of consciousness that can arise. That is a consciousness that must exist outside of rationality, or that must transcend the present understanding of rationality that we have.
Got it. Shall we end here today?